Hey, everybody. I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio, and happy Valentine's Day 2022. Can you guess the date? Yes, it is February 14th. Okay, so happy Valentine's Day to everybody. Hope you got the flowers and get taken out to dinner and all that sort of stuff. It's kind of fun. Okay, so I hope you enjoy yourself. It's a bright, sunny day here in Maine, but we're going to go over to California for today's show. We're going to talk to Kristen Lewis, who is a director of Measure of America. It's measureofamerica.org. Okay, it's a project of the Social Science Research Council. They just did a portrait of California, which showed a lot of glaring racial education disparities in California. And we're going to talk about that because, as you know, we are the voice of equity and access in education. We are the American Consortium for Equity in Education, and everything we do is over at ACE, A-C-E. ACE-ED.org, ACE-ED.org. That's our home website, our magazine, our online journal. Brand new issue is up on site, ACE-ED.org. Just click on the cover of the magazine and enjoy the articles we produce, plus a lot of articles right on site. All of our podcasts are over there and a link to our new website, which is SEL Today, Social Emotional Learning, SELToday.org. So you can enjoy all that. It's just simple. Just everything's at ace-ed.org. All right, without further ado, we're going to go over to California, which is actually the site of the Super Bowl yesterday. Kristen, are you there?
I am. Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Are you kidding me? And where are you? In California, right? I am right there, right? Are you in Sacramento?
You know, our report was on California, but we are actually in the New York area. Our offices are in Brooklyn, actually.
Well, that's close to California.
It's very close. It's close to
California. But the Dodgers were from Brooklyn. Now they're in L.A., so I can make that mistake, can't I?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's a segue there somewhere along the line, and I apologize for that. I thought you were in California. Okay.
No worries. I wish I were. It's 19 degrees where we are right now.
Exactly. I live in Maine, as you might have heard me say. I'm looking
at
a giant pile of snow outside. So I agree. I would agree with you all the way. Tell us about your work before we get into the specifics here about measureofamerica.org. What is that? And you're the director. Just give us the overview.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, we're a project of the Social Science Research Council, which is like a 100-year-old organization that is dedicated to mobilizing social science for the public good. And so our project tries to do that. We work with partners across the country to write reports like Portrait of California, and we also have online tools, and we do a lot of research on youth disconnection. The idea that kind of inspires and guides our work is something called the Human Development Approach. This was developed at the UN in the late 80s, and it really is an optimistic, hopeful concept that puts human freedom and dignity at the center and really emphasizes the everyday experience of ordinary people. It's like about what regular people can do. And it's a very broad concept, and the way we measure it is the American Human Development Index, which kind of instead of like GDP, which asks how's the economy doing, the Human Development Index asks how people are doing. So it's an index that has indicators in health, education, and income, kind of all combined into one and then put on a scale between 0 and 10.
That's cool. And I always like to ask this question because you're the director of the organization, right? Am I correct?
I'm the director of the project,
the
Measure of America project, which is within the larger Social Science Research Council.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And I always love to ask this question. What are you? And people always laugh when I do that. But, you know, are you a sociologist, a historian, an ex-teacher? What are you?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. No one's ever asked that before in an interview. I ask it myself every day as I look in the mirror. What are you? So I have a master's in economic and political development, and I worked at the UN for a long time. And after working for a long time at the UN and at the UN Development Program and then the UN Millennium Project, I really was kind of yearning to work in my own country, you know, and make a contribution of some kind here in the U.S. And I started to feel a little bit of doubt, like, who am I to be telling people in other countries what they should be doing? Because now, you know, there are tons of super smart, really well-educated people all over the world who know their own problems and their own solutions. So I thought, you know, what's next? And a close friend and colleague from the UN had this idea to create this human development report for the U.S. because this idea of a human development report, there's a international one that comes out every year that ranks all the countries using this kind of index. And countries around the world have used it to explore tough issues and allocate resources and do tons of things like that. And my friend and I thought, what about the U.S.? And so we raised money. We started a 501c3, and we ran the project that way as a 501c3 for a few years. And then we joined the Social Science Research Council after a couple of years.
That's a great background, and thank you for that. Okay, sure. I'm glad I asked that question. You know, it's interesting. I'm always curious, you know, because people – you hear that, somebody goes, God, I wish I had that job. And I always like to ask, well, what are you? Or what are you? You know, it's good stuff. I like to ask CEOs of corporations the funny question, what do you do all day? And that invariably makes them laugh.
Yeah, you know, it seems very natural to you when you're doing it all day. But yeah, a lot of people don't really know either how you got there or what you do all day exactly. Yeah.
I think it's great. Okay, I really do. So what did you learn about California? Let me ask the broad question. Okay?
Sure.
And again, we're Education Talk Radio. I know you learned a lot of things. We're going to focus on education for this show. What did you learn about education in California? Just the overall, then we'll get into the specifics.
Sure. So we did, you know, we've been doing these reports. This is our third portrait of California. The first one was in 2011, using 2019 data. So what we saw in terms of education is that there was a lot of progress. So, for instance, in 2009, nearly one in five California adults, 25 and up, did not have a high school diploma. And by 2019, that number had dropped to about 16%. So the state still has a slightly higher rate of adults without high school diplomas than the country as a whole, but still that's a lot of progress in 10 years. In 2009, about 30% of California adults had completed a bachelor's degree or higher, and by 2019 that figure had increased to 35%. So we saw progress overall, but and so that's the good news. But the bad news is that there are still large gaps between racial and ethnic groups between, you know, parts of the state, neighborhoods, and so forth.
Yeah, it's amazing. And how does California, which is gigantic, okay, Bill Maher always makes that joke that North South Dakota, which is the size of, like, one small city, okay, has two senators and so does California, all right?
Yeah.
And how does you did several portraits of California. A, why California? I assume because it's so big and so kind of representative of the country, if I may, ethnically and diversity-wise, et cetera. Why California? And how's that shake out against the rest of the country?
So we did California largely because since we put out our first national report in 2008, we have really had more sort of interest and uptake in California than in most other places, and we were super fortunate to have a lot of funding partners who were very enthusiastic about doing a deep dive in California and then even going beyond that to do county reports in L.A. and Sonoma County, Marin County, and so forth. So I think it was a combination of what you mentioned earlier, which is, of course, that California is fascinating, this idea that the future arrives first in California, that California today has the kind of diversity that the whole country will have is increasingly having and will have more in the future. And then also just sort of interest in funding. You know, we have to raise funding for all of our projects, and we're just really fortunate to have a lot of great partners there.
And let me ask this. Once you get the word out, and we're going to get a little bit into the details, but once you get the word out, who do you get the word out to? Because the research is great. I really appreciate it all. But, you know, there's got to be then we have to act on it. All right? And who wants to know the information? And I do, by the way. I don't mean it to sound so silly. Okay? But who wants to know that information, and what do they want to do with it?
Sure. Well, supposedly when you're writing something like a report like this, you're supposed to have one person in mind, like that you want to influence or inform or connect with the most, right? And so that's super hard because I'm always thinking these reports are for everyone. But I guess when I'm trying to be disciplined, the person is some kind of policymaker who it has to make decisions about education and about allocation of resources and things like that. And that decision maker can be, a school board person. It can be a local official, a municipal official, someone in a big, giant school district like LA, or state legislators, things like that. That's kind of who we're targeting, policymakers. And when we started the project in 2008, my colleagues and I really had the idea that what was missing was just the information, that we could put the data in an easily accessible form, we could make the social science more accessible in terms of language, but also, lots of great research is behind paywalls. So we thought, all that's what's needed is that for this data, for this research to be known and to be packaged in a more accessible form. And we thought, okay, we'll do that, we'll sort of throw it out there, something magical will happen, and then things will change. And it turned out that something magical will happen. That part we didn't really fully understand for a while. So now we do understand it better, and what we realize is that, you really have to work with people on the ground and really understand what kind of report they want, what they will use, what information is missing for them. You have to build relationships so that they trust you and they trust the data and so that they can use it effectively. So now every project we do, we have lots of different advisory boards.
Cool.
We try to work with different institutions so that when we launch a report, people are kind of ready to go and they know how they can use it for advocacy and things like that. So I think that working with people, building consensus, moving together to understand the data and what it's telling us, that's a really, really important step. And it's time-consuming, but without it, things don't really change.
You've got to have the data. So were there any we know that the real disparities perhaps are with the lower-income neighborhoods, okay, lower income schools, perhaps people of color in particular, et cetera. And I'm just kind of saying that off the top of my head. What were the surprises within the report, if there were any?
Oh, that's a really good question. Maybe should I just take a step back and just say what we're measuring?
Just so people understand.
Again, we have this index, and the index measures health, education, and income together. So for health, we calculate life expectancy at birth, so using California Department of Health data, death data. And then for the income portion of the index, we use median personal earnings, so of all workers, 16 and up. So those are the two indicators for that. And for that, we use the American Community Survey of the Census Bureau. And so for education, we use two kinds of indicators. The first is the school enrollment. So it's school enrollment for the population ages 3 to 24. So it captures everyone who's currently in school, from toddlers in preschool to like 24-year-olds in college and graduate schools.
Mm-hmm.
So it covers not just the compulsory years, the years of compulsory schooling, but also those critical early years when disparities in access to knowledge really are already taking shape, as well as the later years, the period of emerging adulthood, when young people really acquire the capabilities they need for a flourishing life. So that's the first part of the indicator. And then the second is educational degree attainment for the population 25 and older. So this indicator is like a snapshot of education in a place or among a group at one point in time. So it measures the share of adults over 25 with high school diplomas, four-year bachelor's degrees, and graduate and professional degrees. And so then we combine these two together. and that's what we get as sort of the indicator. You know, and this idea, education is really so central to this idea of human development, which is about expanding your choices and opportunities, you know. I think people a lot of times think about how education matters for jobs and paychecks, but, you know, it also matters for health and stable relationships and agency and autonomy, and it's really central to the real freedom a person has to decide what to do and who to be in the world. So, you know, education has always been a soft spot for me. I have a lot of teachers in my family. So, yeah, it's I think it's such an important area. And
obviously,
so in terms of surprises, I mean, most of the time we see this general order in terms of race and ethnicity, which is that Asian Californians have the highest index, the highest educational attainment index. And followed by by white Californians. Black Californians come next, then Native Americans, Nahoke, which are Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islanders. And then Latinos have the lowest educational attainment score. In California, so, and then it's important to
recognize. That's amazing, as I think about it historically, because Mexico owned California before we got it. They're actually the natives, if I may, okay, in an odd way, okay, the Latino community. And it's odd. They've been there the longest and are coming in last. It's unbelievable.
And it's important to keep in mind sort of why that is to some degree, you know. So one reason that – well, so two things I want to say. One is that these categories are, of course, very broad. So there's a big difference in terms of people who were born in California and people who immigrated from California or immigrated into, and also among, say, Asian subgroups. So if you look at the high scores of Asian Californians in general, if you disaggregate by subgroup, you see that – for instance, Indian Californians have a score of our 10, it's a 10-point education scale of 9.24, so it's the highest, and say 76 or so percent of an Indian adults have at least a bachelor's degree. Then Taiwanese are quite close on the heels, also with very high educational attainment. And then, but then even the Asian average is 7.51. So again, that's about 2 points higher than for California as a whole. But it's not true for all groups. So for instance, Hmong, Laotian, and Cambodian Californians have a much lower scale, below the state average for California. So for Cambodians, remember, Indians were 3 out of 4 adults have at least a bachelor's degree. For Cambodians, it's 1 out of 4. So it's you can't lump everybody in together under one category. Yeah, you have to. There's a lot of difference, and a lot of people ask why. You know, how is it that Asians in general, and especially lots of these subgroups, have such a high score? A lot of it has to do with the way immigration restrictions were based kind of on education. So immigration reform in 1965 brought a lot of Asian immigrants to the United States, but well-educated immigrants were really privileged. So as a result, the immigrants who came from Asia tended to be better educated than the average American, also better educated than the average person in their own country. So they came here with tons of educational capital, even if they weren't able to translate that into professions. You know, you're trained as an engineer, but maybe you couldn't get a job that way because of language barriers or the credentials didn't match or racism or whatever. You still, even, you know, then maybe you had a small store or something like that, but you still had the educational capital. You still had the education. And there's nothing that is like, there's such a strong association between the educational attainment of parents and the educational attainment of their children. So that's, you know, that's kind of one major reason that the second generation was positioned well to succeed in school.
Can we extrapolate, and you said about Hmong people and the Cambodian people, Laotian people, whatever. Okay, I live in New England. There's a huge population of those groups here in New England. Can we extrapolate out from what you've learned in California and say it's probably the same in Massachusetts, if I may?
Okay, sure.
I'm just curious.
So I think that the lesson to learn is that the educational attainment that people and the circumstances from which people came to the United States is hugely important. So Hmong, Cambodians, Laotian, they came in as refugees largely. They came from extraordinarily difficult circumstances.
Yep.
You know, they had been in war. Their educational trajectories had been profoundly disrupted, of course. So as a result, they have lower educational attainment than other adults. But what we find is that the second generation catches up, just like, you know, it's kind of the American story, right?
Good.
People come from Italy or wherever in the 1800s, and then within one, two generations, people are going to college. And that's kind of such a traditional immigrant story. And
what surprised me, that's why I'll go back to my other point. You know, we're in many, many generations already of Latino people in California, and I would hope by this time, I realize new immigrants are coming in all the time from various Central American and South American countries, okay? But I would hope that by now, okay, we're way beyond second and third generation with this wonderful group of people, and I would hope that they would – I was hoping they would be doing better by now. That's, I guess, my point.
Sure. Well, you know, so about a third of California's Latino population was born outside the United States. And so the high rate of Latino adults who didn't complete high school really reflects the limited opportunities of Latino immigrants in their home countries. But you see then the next generation is, say, graduating high school at the same rate as native-born California. So you definitely see this catching up. And in terms of the overall Human Development Index score in California, over the last 20 years, Latinos have made the quickest progress of any group. So their score overall increased. Yeah, their score overall increased almost 40% in those years. So by far the fastest progress. So, you know, they came with just less education, but, you know, they have really, like other immigrant groups, just really thrived in the United States, and the scores are increasing really fast.
It's so interesting, and I hope at some point you do too, that we don't even have to measure people by where they came from. Everybody's just about at the same place. You know, and that'd be the nicest thing in the world. You know,
would be the very best.
It would be the best. You know, you wrote here on my prep sheet something about youth disconnection, okay? And there's youth disconnection in these varied groups, all right, and racial, ethnic groups, etc. And I'm wondering how that fits into your survey, which is a key thing for the future, if you ask me. Talk about that youth disconnection side and what you learned from that.
Sure. So youth disconnection is the rate of young people between the ages of 16 and 24 who are neither working nor in school. And it's a really crucial measure of how prepared young people are, you know, for college, for careers, and for flourishing adulthoods. And it's also a real measure of how, as a society, we're doing in terms of preparing young people, right? And so in 2019, 10.3% of California youth were disconnected. So that's about 500,000 teens and young adults. So it's a good news, bad news story. So for the last decade, the youth disconnection rate in California has kind of mirrored the national average. It's declined every year between 2010 and 2019. And that was in large part due to the, you know, economic recovery after the Great Recession. You know, more young people were pulled into the labor market. So that's good news, is the rate was falling. The bad news is that, you know, we're concerned that COVID really set back this progress, especially among disadvantaged young people. And then the second thing is that these really significant racial and ethnic disparities kind of persisted. So even though the rates went down, the distance between groups remained very large. So in California, 23.2% of black young people between the ages of 16 and 24 are neither working nor in school. 18.4% of Native American young people 11.2% of Latino young people, about 9% of white young people, and 6% of Asian young people. So you see a huge disparity from 6% among Asian teens and young adults to 23% for black teens and young adults. So, you know, that's a super concerning statistic. Again,
yeah,
the good news.
That's concerning, yeah.
Yeah, so again, the good news for Latino young people is that their rate is about the same rate as the state as a whole, even though the educational attainment for all Latinos is lower than the state average. You can see how young people are already changing that with fairly average youth disconnection rates. You know, and it's important to think that disconnection isn't like this spontaneous occurrence, like things aren't going great and
right.
kids are doing great
right.
in school, and then
point.
Suddenly they're neither working nor in school unless something terrible has happened, you know, like there's a terrible illness or something like that. In general, this is something that's years in the making, and it really comes from these deep structural issues and longstanding inequities and a lack of educational and employment opportunities available to young people in certain areas and certain groups.
So then, you've got an education system that's public. They have a new superintendent, wonderful superintendent now, Alberto Carvalho from Miami. He's now in L.A. All right. Talk to me about what's the next step. When they have this information, what are the changes that need to be implemented? Kristen.
Sure. Well, I guess, first of all, is your bread and butter, right? It's the focus on equity. We really have to make education realize its promise as an engine of social progress. And it's for too many people, it just isn't right now, right? And our young people who experience the greatest disadvantages, they really deserve the very best schools we as a society can provide. But in general, they're getting the worst schools we can provide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know,
great point, by the way.
And that matters. It matters for them, of course, but, you know, a strong and dynamic California really depends on everyone having the skills they need to have a productive,
yeah,
rewarding, freely chosen life, right? So ensuring that all of our young people get really good education, a really good start in life, matters to everybody. So I guess in terms of what people should do, is the first thing is really mitigate the health and educational and economic impacts of COVID-19 by focusing on the most vulnerable communities because,
mm-hmm.
You know, low-income communities of color in particular had the greatest educational challenges.
Yes, they did.
Before. They were hardest hit by COVID, and
yep.
they're facing the steepest climb to recovery. So really prioritizing those communities and communities that have low scores on the Human Development Index for educational dollars is critically important. So that's the first thing. And then the second is sort of to build a more equitable system moving forward. I mean, this
yeah.
idea that a crisis provides an opportunity. There are a lot of dollars floating around now. Yes, we
yep.
hope they can. Hope it does. So, you know, expanding programs for the youngest Californians is critically important, and that's happening. You know, that's really happening in California in terms of universal pre-K, and so that's really heartening. Because that's really when these educational gaps are first apparent, you know, is in these early years. Really ensuring that the additional resources for K-12 education reach those in the most need. There was a local control funding formula introduced several years back that was really designed to direct educational dollars toward the kids who need them most. Research has shown that hasn't really worked out. Too many of these funds have
yeah,
just gone into sort of...
figure that out, why that hasn't happened.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, they've just gone into
the
general
pool. You know? Yeah,
yeah,
it's just unbelievable. Well, what doesn't make sense is that, I'll just use L.A., okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not an expert in L.A., but let's just use it. L.A. is one big school district.
Right.
They have X amount of millions of dollars. There should not be under-resourced. They know which schools need it the most. Okay, and because it's one school district, if I may, they can put those dollars where they need them to be the most. Okay, there shouldn't be an under-resourced school in a lower socioeconomic neighborhood.
Yeah,
that's
but that's what we see.
Dumb.
You know, even
yeah.
even schools in the same district will be incredibly different in terms of the resources they have, the activities they offer, the course load, and there's just no reason for that. You know, you can't really justify that, right?
Well, there is no justification for it at all if it's one school district.
Right.
Okay? Right. You know, and it happens also. I mean, my kids were raised in New Hampshire, all right? And there it's really local funding. Okay, it's a very localized system of taxation. And the kids in the poor towns did not have the same opportunities that where our kids grew up in Exeter, one of the richer towns.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
And the kids upstate, you know, it just doesn't make sense. And it never does to me, and we just got to do something about that. Okay, the time is now.
Yeah, I mean, the way schools are funded combined with residential segregation creates a profoundly inequitable system that most most affluent democracies don't have anything like this, right? They have a central education budget, and so they can create equity in terms of what
they
schools
can
offer.
We have to. We have to. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, no. I was just saying one thing also that really struck me as we were doing this report on California, we also did spotlight reports on some different regions with different partners, and we did one on the Inland Empire, and one of the people on the advisory board made this great comment in terms of recommendations, and we haven't talked too much about higher ed, but he talked about the importance of making higher education student-ready rather than just focusing on making young people college-ready.
I agree with him.
That was just so great, you know, because there aren't that many as a proportion of students who are sort of what we think of as traditional college students, you know, dependent on their parents, having residence at a college full-time and things like that. Those are the college students we hear about all the time. But I think now most students are going to school part-time. They're adults. They have caretaking responsibilities.
Exactly.
And so we have to make college ready for them and able to meet their needs with things as simple as, like, having parking lots so people can, like, get to class from work and find somewhere to park.
Yeah.
Or, you know, child care, having classes at night. You know, there are lots and lots of things that would accommodate what we call non-traditional students, but who are really the kind of average student nowadays.
Unfortunately, they are becoming the traditional student.
Yeah.
Okay? That's the term non-traditional student. That's term should almost be left behind us.
Yeah,
I agree. The world is changing.
Yeah,
the world is changing, and your report, you know, points that out. Okay, it's a measure of where we are now, and we've just got to make these changes. It's good stuff. It's all at measureofamerica.org, and everybody
can
go over there and check it out. You can tell everybody you listen to Kristen Lewis, who is just great. You're a good lady, Kristen. It's nice to have you here.
Larry, it's been great talking with you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it as well. I really did. Thank you so much for the hard work you do. Okay?
Likewise.
And good stuff, all right? And have fun in Brooklyn. What can I tell you? Watch out for them trolleys. You got to be a trolley dodger. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? You know what I'm talking about?
Is that why the team was called the Dodgers?
Yes. They were the trolley dodgers.
Oh, my gosh, I did not know that.
Because there were so many trolley lines, they had to try to not get killed on the way to the park.
That is so interesting. Wow. Okay, cool.
The Dodgers. There you go. See, you learned something. Stick with me. You'll learn something you can never use again except in a bar bet. So do that.
Well, that's the best kind of knowledge, I think.
The best kind. Okay. Kristen, thanks a million.
Thanks, Larry. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
I hope to talk to you again at some point. Bye-bye.
I hope we do. Okay, let's stay in touch, and I'll write you when we're done. So thank you.
Okay,
take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was just terrific, everybody. Okay? That's Kristen Lewis, author of A Portrait of California from measureofamerica.org, which is part of the Social Science Research Council. We'll archive at ace-ed.org. Check out what we do, all about equity. I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks for listening, and once again, happy Valentine's Day.